well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. Going to be talking with William Kirk from Washington Gun Law here in just a moment or two. A number of topics to discuss with William. We're starting with a new law in Washington that is really bad news for gun owners who might have ever been arrested for a DUI. When my colleague Tom Knighton was writing about this law last week, he mentioned that the law on the surface says that if you've been convicted of two or more DUI offenses within, I think it's a 5 or 7 year period, then you lose your right to keep and bear arms. As William says, it's actually worse than that. But while we had William on the program, I also want to ask about what's going on in Seattle, where the city attorney is planning on using the state's red flag law to disarm sex traffickers without actually putting sex traffickers behind bars. There's a head scratcher for you. And then William and I had a great conversation about one of the four state level cases in Virginia right now challenging the upcoming ban on so-called assault firearms and magazines. In fact, this is a case, Curtis versus Katz. There's a hearing today, as I'm recording this, taking place in Spotsylvania County. What's interesting about this particular case, I've written about it at Bearing Arms as well, is that this is not making an argument that, hey, this violates the individual right to keep and bear arms that is found in Article 1, Section 13 of the Virginia Constitution. Instead, the argument is, hey, this violates the militia clause of Article 1, Section 13 of the Virginia Constitution, which states that the militia is composed of the body of the people in Virginia. It is it's a different approach, one that I'm cautiously optimistic will find favor with the courts here. William's pretty excited about it as well. So a plethora of topics on the table here when we spoke with William Kirk from Washington Gun Law. Take a look and a listen. William, thank you so much for joining me on the program, sir. It's good to see you.
Likewise, Cam. Real honor to be here. Thank you.
Well, listen, I always appreciate the invite to appear on Washington Gun Law, so I'm glad that I could return the favor. And we got a lot of stuff to talk about. You actually reached out to me after my colleague Tom Knighton wrote a piece for Bearing Arms about this new law in Washington that will disarm repeat DUI offenders, right? I think after two DUIs, you lose your right to keep your arms. You can still get your driver's license, oddly enough. You can still get behind the wheel of a car at some point in the future, but you can't own a gun. And you reached out, you said it's actually worse than that, right? So what's going on with this law?
Yeah, so the legislation was passed the same summer we passed our assault weapon ban, but no one was paying attention. I was screaming bloody murder about this one, but everyone was freaking out about the platform ban. But the way it works in Washington State is if you have two, as the statute defines it, DUI prior offenses within a 7 year period, you will be disarmed as if you'd been convicted of a Class C felony, even though you'd never been charged with a Class C felony. What makes it worse than what was actually reported is that when you look at RCW 4661-5055, which is the DUI sentencing statute, specifically subsection 14, there's actually 17 different ways that a person can accumulate what's considered a DUI prior offense. So you could actually have individuals who got charged with two DUIs 5 years apart. There was evidentiary issues with both. A good attorney goes in and gets it reduced to a negligent driving or a reckless driving or something like that. I'm not condoning the activity of impaired driving whatsoever, but with zero DUI convictions, you will have been disarmed for a period of 5 years. And it's actually longer than that because it's 5 years before you're eligible to even begin the reinstatement process.
Oh, wow. So it's not just being convicted. If you are charged, it sounds like initially.
If you are convicted of something that started as a DUI, we also in Washington State have something known as a deferred prosecution where, you know, sometimes, especially if you're getting into multiple DUIs, there may be an unhealthy relationship with substances at that point.
Right.
And so we have treatment alternatives in this state where a person can contractually agree to enter into 2 years worth of treatment and maintain sobriety for 5 years and be able to work that case off their record. It's a wonderful program, but the statute still defines that as a prior offense, and you would be disarmed in that situation as well.
So this is a mandatory 5 year loss of gun rights, but it's not that those rights are automatically restored after that 5 year period is over too, right?
Correct. There's a restoration process by which you have to go through in Washington State, which is fairly straightforward, but time consuming and usually involves a lawyer.
Okay. You know, and again, I mean, we look at, I'm with you. I'm not condoning, anybody getting behind the wheel while they're intoxicated. I've lost friends and family to drunk drivers. So, you know, as much as I hate the driver disarmament policies and the rider disarmament policies of Uber and Lyft, take a ride share, take a cab, walk home, give your friend the key, do whatever is got to be done.
Yes. Amen.
But you know, we're also talking again, we've seen this in you know, various courts around the country, the idea that in order to be disarmed, you have to be dangerous, right? There has to be that presumption of dangerous. And I don't know. I mean, do you think it's a stretch to say, well, you know, if somebody may have gotten behind the wheel of a car twice over a 5-year period when they were intoxicated, that makes them too dangerous to own a firearm? Is that too much of a stretch?
I think it's too much of a stretch. I think they might be a little too dangerous to be driving a car. They might be too dangerous to drive in a car without an interlock in there. But it has absolutely nothing to do with their, say, you know, handling of firearms. I think the thing that's more concerning is the ruling of the Washington State Supreme Court, which was a 5-4 ruling. So that tells you that this law was on mildly shaky grounds, because I can promise you there's not a single conservative judge on that bench. But the concerning thing, and this is what I'm going to worry that's going to spread across the country, is what the Supreme Court said is, well, the legislature labeled this group as dangerous. And because they have labeled them as dangerous, they are dangerous. And we can't second guess that. So, you know, who else is dangerous is, you know, young people who drive 20, 30, 40 miles an hour over the speed limit routinely, you know, chronic speeders. We have them. Every community has them. Absolutely. That's dangerous. Does that make them dangerous and unfit to possess a firearm? That's the problem. And if we allow states to continue to just put these broad labels of dangerousness on any category of crime, that's how we increase the disarmament industrial complex.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, and this is an issue in Hamani, right? We're still waiting on the Supreme Court's opinion. But, you know, I think the expectation is that the court is likely to say that individuals who use marijuana are not inherently dangerous and cannot be, you know, prohibited from possessing a firearm. Do you think there's the opportunity to revisit this issue if the Supreme Court provides additional clarification about the dangerousness standard in Hamani?
Yeah, I think there's an opportunity to revisit it. Unfortunately, that revisitation will take place in the Ninth Circuit now. So, you know, don't hold your breath on that one.
Yeah. Okay. I also wanted to ask you, I've been writing about this a couple of times. In Seattle, there's an issue, I guess, in the north part of the city, Aurora Boulevard. Yep. You've got a lot of prostitution. You've got drug dealing. You've got turf wars. And the Uber left politicians in Seattle, people are so fed up. They set up barricades, on side streets so that, you know, the criminals couldn't come in. The city removes those. Now they're saying, well, we'll put our own up in place. But they've talked about how hard it is to, you know, prosecute sex trafficking. And you know, we're not going to go after the Johns because that's a misdemeanor offense. So they'll find to enforce misdemeanor gun laws. But, the city attorney has said that she wants to use the state's red flag law to try to disarm these sex traffickers who are, you know, shooting at each other over turf wars. And I'm thinking about this, William, and I'm thinking, all right, so you're going to have to know this individual's name. You're going to have to convince a judge that there's probable cause that this individual is a danger to themselves or others. At that point, why not just arrest them for sex trafficking? Why not arrest them for shooting? I mean, I don't get this at all.
Well, this is what happens when you have a criminal justice system that is working overtime to remove accountability from the criminal justice system. And this is not unique to Seattle. There are other jurisdictions out here on this side of the country, Portland, Oregon, San Francisco, Los Angeles, where they have systematically removed accountability from the criminal justice system. And even though I've made my living as a criminal defense attorney, I can assure you that the criminal justice system only works when we have accountability. This is much akin to what we see with Glock lawsuits, where it's like, well, because people are doing a bunch of illegal activities, what we need to do is actually pass laws to ban legal items. It's just a general desire to not seek accountability of those folks. Washington has watered down the sex trafficking laws and the prostitution laws for years. When I was a prosecutor many, many, many years ago, we did prosecute these cases. We prosecuted them a little bit differently than they attempt to prosecute them now. No method has worked, has proven to be effective at this point. And I don't think they're really seriously committed to stopping sex trafficking in the Aurora corridor there, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious to see how many red flag petitions actually get approved.
Well, I'm interested to see who petitions, because in Washington State, the only two people who can petition for a red flag would be law enforcement or an immediate family member of the respondent of the order.
So the city attorney can't even do this herself, then.
She cannot sua sponte do it. It would require a Seattle police officer, would be the most practical one.
Right.
But I can assure you that if you've got the pimp on some other types of criminal offenses, there's other ways to disarm them too. It's called charge them with the felonies and then disarm them in arraignment.
Yeah. I don't, mission creep, for the red flag statute. Again, we were, told that this was going to be, when these things first popped on the scene, it was kind of like how Democrats described abortion back in the 90s, right? They wanted it to be safe, right, legal, and rare. And now we just see this, rush to use these red flag laws as often and as broadly as possible. We've got a red flag law.
Viewers should take a very careful look at how Colorado does their red flag laws, because when you want to see a state that's really on the cutting edge of trying to expand red flag laws, Colorado.
Yeah. They just passed a law this year that allows for institutions to file red flag petitions. And I'm still trying to figure out how that works, because there's a provision in the Colorado law that says if you provide false information in a red flag petition, you can face criminal charges. So what happens if it's an institution that is applying? How do you punish the institution?
Yeah, who's the individual you punish? They're using medical professionals as well. So they're using educators, medical professionals, counselors, and things like that. Basically, what they're going to eventually do is encapsulate every type of human being that you must do business with and allow them to petition for red flags on you. Your bankers, your insurance agents, everyone will be involved in it.
Oh, God. All the more reason to leave Colorado. We've got a red flag law in Virginia. It is hard to find information about how often it is used. It was put in place back in 2020, the last time Democrats had a trifecta in state government. And of course, now Governor Spanberger had her ceremonial bill signing yesterday, the dog and pony show, signing more than 20 bills into law. She'd already approved these bills, so this was just purely ceremonial. But among those bills, William, we've got the ban on so-called assault firearms and large-capacity magazines. We've got multiple federal lawsuits. We've got four different lawsuits filed in various parts of the state. And today in Spotsylvania County, in fact, as you and I are talking, a hearing is supposed to be taking place regarding, I think this is on a motion for an injunction.
It is.
And this deals the every one of these cases filed in state court are a little bit different. They raise different points of law. This is really interesting because this claim is based on the militia clause of Section 1, Article 13 of the Virginia Constitution, which says that a well-regulated militia, which is comprised of the body of the people, well-trained, right, is an inherent protection against tyranny. And you've got former Attorney General, former Virginia Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli representing the plaintiffs in this case.
Yeah.
You've read his brief. What
Video
do you make
out
of
right
his
now
argument?
On it? I think it's brilliant. First of all, you got to understand, Cam, I read so many of these things that it's just ditto, ditto, ditto. It's the same argument. So when you get something that's you and unique, it's kind of nice and refreshing. But what I love about this is there's a little bit of a game of 4D chess being played here. If you take a look at some of the other cases that are challenging under state constitutional grounds, take, for example, Crump v. Katz. Mm-hmm. The state replied on that one and said, hey, Article 1, Section 13 of the Virginia State Constitution, it does not even convey an individual right whatsoever. It only conveys a collective right, which is tied to militia service. So they wanted to go down that road. What Ken Cuccinelli did is like say, okay, well, that's fine. If you want to play it that way, well, here's the problem. The problem is that it's in violation of the militia clause. What the state of Virginia is claiming is that Article 1, Section 13 only has three core principles: the militia, the dangers of standing armies, and subordination of the military to civil powers. And so the plaintiffs are saying, okay, well, then this is in violation of the entire militia clause as a whole. In addition, they have filed a separate one under the individual right to keep and bear arms. But it's a fantastic legal strategy where the state of Virginia thought they were getting a little cute with their arguments, and now they got themselves painted into a corner. So kudos to plaintiff's counsel. The fact that this case was not removed from Spotsylvania County, whereas those other cases, there's a little bit of gamesmanship going on with that, is exciting. And I'm hopeful that you and I will be announcing at some point later today or later this week that there is an injunction that has been issued on that.
Fingers crossed. Yeah, I mean, we've seen the Virginia State Supreme Court appoint this three-judge panel to consider whether these cases should be consolidated and if they should be removed to a particular county. The Attorney General would love it to be Richmond, Virginia, right? And we did see a judge in Lancaster County in Crump versus Katz basically say, all right, I'm calling a timeout, canceled a hearing on a preliminary injunction that was supposed to take place last Friday. I said, I'm going to wait for the Supreme Court to that panel to make its decision. GOA filed a brief saying, you don't have to do that. And we really would like you to hold this hearing. Judge hasn't acted on that, but I got to tell you, I was nervous, William. I was a little concerned that the judge in Spotsylvania County would do the same thing. It does not look like that is the case.
Well, I think the thing is, Cam, is because if you take a look at Crump v. Katz and some of those other cases, they are taking a much more traditional attack using Article 1, Section 13. What you got in Curtis v. Katz, the one out in Spotsylvania County, is this very unique militia clause argument. Mm-hmm. So consolidating that case with all the other cases would have actually been inappropriate. It's one thing if you got three cases in three counties and they're all arguing the same thing. I can see, at least for legal efficiency, why consolidation would do it. But when you got a fourth case that's an apple when everything else is an orange, no, you shouldn't be consolidating those.
You know, and that militia clause argument too. I mean, when you talk about AA for standing, but also when it comes to the ban itself, right? The state of Virginia is arguing that, basically regurgitating the Fourth Circuit's argument that, well, these guns are unusually dangerous. They're not suitable for self-defense. If you're raising a militia clause argument, then the argument is not whether or not they're suitable for individual self-defense. The argument is whether or not they are, whether they serve any sort of militia purpose, right? And in that case, the state of Virginia has basically said that, yes, they do. I mean, they've basically conceded that point in cases like Crump versus Katz.
That's right. That's right. And it is rare that you see, and this was, I don't know if this was an accidental strategy or if Cuccinelli really just played this thing out perfectly like a chessboard to wait for the state of Virginia to make that initial response in those first cases, then take their theory, turn it around on them and shove it back down their throat. It's, as a lawyer, I'm really appreciative of the work there.
All right. Well, hopefully, again, we do get some good news from Spotsylvania County. I'm keeping my fingers crossed.
The state needs some good news. You guys need some good news out there. It's been a rough few months for you guys out there.
Yeah, it has been. And there's more to come. You know, the one saving grace right now, there are a couple of saving graces. A, the Attorney General is Jay Jones. And I'm not an attorney, so maybe I shouldn't throw shade at attorneys, but I don't think he's the sharpest tool in the legal shed. And we're starting to see a lot of infighting among Democrats. At the ceremonial bill signing yesterday, there were two lawmakers whose bills were supposed to be signed. They're there in the room, and one of Spanberger's staffers comes over and says, your bills aren't being signed today because you chummed around with State Senator Louise Lucas, and you went on a listening tour about data centers, and Lucas and Spanberger are at odds with one another over taxing data centers. And so because these two lawmakers were part of Team Lucas, they were told, You don't get to be a part of the dog and pony show. You can stick around and watch, but your bills aren't getting signed. And so they left. So Spanberger's not playing well with other Democrats. Other Democrats aren't playing well with Spanberger. That has not impacted, gun control legislation this session. But if there continues to be this devolution of cooperation in Richmond, maybe that benefits gun owners next year. We'll see.
Maybe. Yeah. And then, of course, the question is, how much more is there left for them to take from you after what they did this legislative session?
Well, yeah. I mean, listen, they did leave a lot on the table. They left the $500 tax on suppressors. That may come back. It may come back as just a suppressor ban. 11% excise tax on firearms and ammunition. Originally, the gun ban and magazine ban bill banned the possession of large capacity magazines. So they may come back and do that next year. Yeah. I mean, you know how it works. You live in Washington State. You see this all the time, right?
I want the folks out in Virginia to be real careful about pre-purchasing licensing. That, to me, is one of the biggest dangers. I know that bill kicked around in Virginia this year, and they'll be back with a vengeance on that one next year.
Yeah, that was another one. You're right. Permit to purchase. Yeah. And it wasn't just...
And that's a dangerous, dangerous law, because once we have a pre-purchase license, it's no longer a right. We've converted the right into a privilege.
Yeah. I need to have you back on to talk about that and you know, that push for permit to purchases in light of the Bruin decisions, assumption that shall issue licensing for concealed carry or for public carry is appropriate.
Footnote 9. Yeah. Now, one of the most interpreted 81 words in the history of American jurisprudence, to be honest with you. So I'd love to talk to you about that sometime.
Well, William, again, thanks so much for joining me on the program today. Tell folks, I'm sure most of them already know, but to tell folks how they can watch Washington Gun Law and what you guys focus on there.
Yeah, well, Washington Gun Law, we're available at YouTube at Washington Gun Law. We will give it to you straight. We'll break down all legislation, litigation, self-defense issues. We are lawyers who try to not talk like lawyers. We are content creators who try to not tell you how to think, but just to give you all the stuff to think about, because we think you're all big boys and big girls, can make up your own minds. So if you want to get a quick summary of what's going on in about 10 to 12 minutes with someone using simple English, tune on into Washington Gun Law.
William, thank you so much for your time, sir. Look forward to talking to you again soon.
Great pleasure. Thank you very much, Cam.
My thanks once again to William for joining us on the program. Always enjoy our conversations and looking forward to having him back. Now that I know that he'll get up bright and early on the West Coast to join the program here. Forward to having them on more often. Right now, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. Not a true recidivist report. I believe this is a first offense. At least I hope it's a first offense given the age of the offender. But it is, again, one of those cases that just leaves you scratching your head about why on earth this sentence was handed down in the first place. It's from New Mexico. The headline here, Las Cruces teen gets 5 years probation after shooting friend during gun heist plot. Yeah. And it doesn't sound like this was an accidental shooting. At least that's not what he was charged with. Evan Gabriel Martinez ended up pleading guilty to attempted first-degree murder and still was sentenced to nothing more than 5 years probation after he shot a 15-year-old friend in the back while they were both in an alleyway planning to steal some guns from a friend's home last October. According to KFOX Channel 14 in New Mexico, Martinez and the victim met near the home after they'd been messaging each other online, planning a burglary. Investigators say that on the victim's phone, they found messages that detailed how the owner of the home was going to leave the back door open for them to enter and take the guns because that they planned to sell later on. So apparently the homeowner was involved in this plot. I don't get this. But the victim told investigators that he agreed to meet Martinez in an alleyway near a dollar store to assist in the burglary. The victim then described that at one point while he was walking in front of Martinez, Martinez shot him in the back, leaving him on the ground bleeding and yelling for help. According to police documents, investigators ended up finding Martinez in his home the very same day. So, A, it seems like you've got some pretty significant witness testimony, right, to corroborate this charge. You've got, obviously, a lot of physical evidence to corroborate this charge. So why was a plea deal even offered here? Why not take this case to trial? And if you're going to offer a plea deal, why offer a deal that results in nothing more than probation? Martinez can't drink. He can't possess alcoholic beverages, can't enter a liquor store, can't use drugs, can't have a gun. Must be in school or employed full-time, has to submit to random drug tests, has to avoid contact with the victim and witnesses, has to complete an anger management program, and perform 50 hours of community service. Okay, but again, attempted first-degree murder? 5 years probation? That sentence just does not comport with the charge, in my opinion. And again, as we've seen all too often, you know, when there are no serious consequences for serious crimes, it often leads the defendant to believe that they can go on to commit more serious crimes without suffering any consequences. I hope that's not the case for Mr. Martinez here. I hope he's able to turn his life around, but got to tell you, not all that confident. Today's armed citizen story from the Memphis, Tennessee area, shooting an injured man inside Cordova home, ruled self-defense, according to the Shelby County Sheriff's Office. Don't have a ton of information about this. This happened early Monday, and police have already determined that this was self-defense, so that's good news. Sometimes these cases will drag on for weeks, months, before the armed citizen is told that, no, you don't have to worry about facing any charges here. Deputies responded about 6:30 Monday morning to a shooting in Cordova. They found a man who'd been shot. He was taken to a local hospital in critical condition. Deputies say they believe the shooting stemmed from a domestic dispute, and originally they detained one person. The sheriff's office said the condition of the man who was shot had improved. He is expected to survive, but no other details about the domestic dispute were released, so we don't know, again, anything about the armed citizen. Don't know what led up to, or frankly, the perpetrator of this domestic dispute, who apparently was the one who was shot. We just know that, again, that individual is expected to survive. Don't know if they'll be facing any charges either, as a matter of fact. Ordinarily, the sheriff's office would say, you know, once this individual gets out of the hospital, they'll be arraigned on, you know, charges X, Y, and Z. But in this case, we don't even have any more information about that. So hopefully we will get more details, but it is good to know that the individual who did pull the trigger, not facing any charges because police believe they were acting in defense of themselves or others. Finally, today, our good deed of the day, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. Some citizens in Indiana, along with the Indiana State Police, who saved a man from a burning burning car, rather, in Fulton County, Indiana. This was June the 9th. Indiana State Police Captain Bob Burgess, First Sergeant Josh Rossi responded to a vehicle crash on State Road 17 in rural Fulton County. Initial reports indicated that the vehicle was on its side, was on fire. There was an individual trapped inside. When they arrived at the scene a short time later, they found two individuals who lived nearby who were already there, a guy named Jeff Smith and Sam Smith, and they were attempting to remove the driver, who was, in fact, trapped inside that vehicle. The four individuals then tried to extinguish the fire as the flames intensified, were unable to do so, but according to the police, quote, acting swiftly and at personal risk, the four were able to successfully extricate the driver before the flames reached the vehicle's interior. Preliminary investigation shows that the driver suffered a medical emergency, which caused him to run off the road, caused the vehicle to overturn. The driver was taken to a local hospital for further treatment. And the Indiana State Police say that the citizen's actions and the troopers, quote, undoubtedly prevented serious injury or death to the driver. So in the right place at the right time, willing able to do the right thing. Jeff Smith and Sam Smith on the scene before the state troopers even got there. We appreciate and thank you for your very, very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms Cam and Company. I want to thank you as always for being a part of the program, and I'm looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. Be sure to check out BearingArms.com today. We're keeping up to date on all the latest Second Amendment news and information across the nation. And if you are not already a VIP Gold or Platinum member, I would encourage you to do so. Just go to BearingArms.com/subscribe. You can take 60% off your VIP, VIP Gold or VIP Platinum membership when you use the promo code FIGHT. And one of the benefits of being a Gold and Platinum member, you get great benefits at every tier of support, but one of the cool things for our Gold and Platinum members, every Wednesday, 1:30 Eastern, we do our VIP live chat with Hot Airs at Morrissey and myself. We're not the only VIP live chat, by the way. There are a lot of other chats that take place during the week, but Ed and I get together on Wednesday afternoons at 1:30 Eastern. We get to hang out for about an hour. We talk about whatever our VIP members want to talk about. Usually there's some 2A topics. It's a really fun hour. If you can't participate live, you can always catch it on demand. But we love to have our VIP members there, and it's usually a great conversation. It's one of my favorite hours. In fact, it is probably the favorite hour of my work week, and I'd love for you to be a part of it. Again, just go to BearingArms.com/subscribe. Use the promo code FIGHT and take 60% off your VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum membership. Enjoy the rest of your Hump Day Wednesday. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well. Be safe. Be free.